Good morning, everybody. Bear with us for one second. This is our first time doing this by Zoom. So good morning, everybody. My name is Michael Gibb. I'm the president and CEO of Gotze & Gibb Wealth Management. And I'd like to thank everybody here for taking the time to join us for this first State of the Economy call of 2022. I think it's going to be a very timely call, and there's certainly a lot to talk about. Just as a brief housekeeping item, because we're doing this in a new format over Zoom, there is a chat button at the bottom of the screen, and you can use that to answer questions or submit feedback at any time during the presentation. Any questions that you do submit will be visible only to our team here, and nobody else attending the call will be able to see it. Jean is going to spend about 30 minutes of the call on her prepared remarks and then use the remaining time to answer questions. She's going to go ahead and start with questions that were submitted through our questions inbox before the call. And then if we have additional time, she'll go ahead and tackle some of the questions we get during the call. If we run out of time before Jean gets to your questions, we will answer that promptly in our follow-up communication after the call. With that, I think I'm out of housekeeping items, and I'll go ahead and turn it over to the person that everyone really wants to see, Jean McGowan.
Great. Thank you, Michael, and good morning, everyone. As Michael said, I'm going to spend about 30 minutes going through the slides, which you should have received, and then I will address some questions and obviously any questions that come in. So bear with me one moment while I share my screen, and we will get going on the presentation. Great. So again, welcome. I know there's an awful lot going on and an awful lot of uncertainty in the market right now. So as Michael said, this is a great time to have this call. We seem to have really good timing in these calls occurring when all kinds of uncertain events are happening. And it's really hard to believe that we just passed the 2-year anniversary of the COVID-related equity market bottom, March 23rd, 2020. Since that time, the S&P is up 111% or 44% on an annualized basis. And so a lot has happened between the call 2 years ago and now. We've been hoping for the better part of 2 years to be able to turn the page on the COVID pandemic and move on to new topics. Unfortunately, we got what we asked for, but we did not ask for that topic to be a war in Ukraine. And that's certainly impacting, at least over the near term, our outlook for growth and inflation, which I'll talk about in more detail as we go through the slides. Just real quick, coming into the year, we were looking for increased volatility in both the economy and the financial markets due to the economic transition from emergency stimulus, both monetary and fiscal, from the broadening of the inflationary pressures we saw last year, the lingering impacts of COVID, rising geopolitical risks, which have now escalated from where we were at the beginning of the year. And the one that we still have not talked much about, but probably will later this year, is the upcoming midterm elections. You know, all of those uncertainties that we highlighted as we came into the year are still there. And in the case of the war in Ukraine, we do know that those are going to have impacts globally on growth and inflation. So in the call, and as I go through the slides, there's kind of four key things that you'll be hearing, hopefully that clearly in the message. First is we continue to expect volatility in both the economy and the markets to last for some time. And just for clarification, when we talk about volatility in the economy, what that's really looking at is, you know, normally in an economic recovery, you sort of have steady growth throughout the year and throughout a cycle. When there's volatility in the economy, what you have are a lot of short-term headwinds that could impact consumer spending today, but don't really change the fundamental strength of the consumer. So you get maybe a particularly weak quarter followed by a bounce back quarter that might be stronger than you expected. Some of those short-term headwinds, obviously today, are the spike in energy prices, you know, COVID resurgence, which is impacting supply chains in China. But we've seen it in the first quarter of the year, sometimes due to weather, where that impacts near-term spending, but it really doesn't change the strength of the consumer. So we expect, you know, that we're going to see positive quarters, some very weak quarters. It's not unheard of that we could see a negative GDP quarter, just depending on how all of these factors come together. But we want to really focus longer term on the underlying fundamental strength of the consumer and the economy. Market volatility, you know, we talk about a lot. It's been showing up this year, much more so in the intraday moves in the market. Normally, in a typical year, there are about 33 days where the market moves more than 2% from the time it opens in the morning until it closes at the end of the day. Last year, we had 14, so significantly less volatility last year. So far this year, there have been 23 days where we've seen that greater than 2% move. So we expect that to continue. We have seen, for the first time in almost 2 years, a correction in the market. It began almost immediately at the beginning of the year. The S&P 500 peaked on January 3rd and then declined 13%. We are seeing a recovery there. But again, corrections are part of the market, but they are an offshoot of all of the uncertainty that we're seeing. And we expect that type of volatility could continue throughout the year. And then finally, volatility in the interest rate markets. Short-term rates are up significantly on the expectations and now the start of Fed tightening. Longer-term interest rates have been more volatile to both the up and the downside lately, you know, moving up on the impact of higher short-term rates, but then also seeing some downward pressure on flight to quality trades. And we'll go into all of this in much more detail. The second kind of key focus area is the fact that the Fed has started policy normalization. And we're going to talk about what the Fed needs to do, what they can and can't do. And, you know, the idea that an active Fed, you know, it creates additional uncertainty. The possibility of a policy mistake out of the Fed is certainly not zero. And they've made their task more difficult by delaying the start of this process. And it's made more difficult by the war in Ukraine. And we'll talk about that in more detail. But I think, you know, hopefully a key theme that you'll see is that higher interest rates don't necessarily mean a recession or problems for the economy. We just have to watch as the data moves forward. Inflation is going to be a key theme throughout everything that I'm talking about. We expect that inflationary pressures will worsen over the near term because of the war in Ukraine, but we expect that it will lessen later in the year, but still remain above the Fed's target. And again, while inflation can be challenging for consumers and businesses, it's not automatically a bad thing for the equity market or for the economy when it's at a more reasonable level. So we'll take a closer look at the nature of current inflationary pressures and what it will take to address those. And then finally, we'll talk about the outlook for financial markets and how we're dealing with the current environment from a portfolio management perspective. If you take one message away from today, I would hope that it's one of cautious optimism. You know, we certainly understand all of the uncertainties that are out there in the global economy today and the headwinds that we're facing over the near term, but we think there are some key underlying factors in the US economy that can still sustain economic growth. So with that long introduction, I'm going to move into the charts, and I'm going to start on page 2. The chart you're looking at here is a graph of the dollar value of US GDP over time. You know, I think a couple of things that are important to see here. The darker bluish line is the GDP, both historically, and it's a little bit harder to see, but the last section of that is dashed. My dashes are a little compressed on the screen, so hopefully you can see them. But this includes estimates for GDP growth through the end of 2023. And then the dashed green line is the long-term trend of GDP. And that's averaged about 2% a year over time. And what I wanted to point out here is even with all of the uncertainty overhanging the global economy, we still expect GDP growth to be positive this year and next year. I would say our estimates for this year have come down from where they were at the beginning of the year. And that's due to the disruption both higher energy prices and more supply chain disruption out of China due to their zero COVID policy. So while we expected a more robust first half of this year, those estimates have come down. In the second half, we were already expecting growth to begin to slow more towards trend, and 2023 hasn't so far seen significant change. We still expect it to come in much closer to the long-term trend line of 2%. You know, and I think the other thing that's important to reiterate here is that while we expect positive growth, you know, we do acknowledge that the risks to this outlook are less certain than they were at the beginning of the year. And we can't rule out the possibility of slower than expected economic growth or a negative quarter, depending on how the headwinds near term lay out. Given that, you might be asking, well, where's the cautious optimism coming from? So I'm going to address that right now. You know, the reason why we are still cautiously optimistic about this outlook for growth is, first, the U.S. economy is primarily a consumer-based economy. More than two-thirds of GDP growth comes from consumer spending, and the consumer is healthy right now. You know, certainly high energy prices are hitting disposable income, but savings levels are still strong. The labor market is strong, and those who want a job can mostly find it. Excess savings are not as high as they were throughout most of the pandemic, but they are still, for the most part, people have more cash on their personal balance sheets than they have in the past. And generally, debt levels are low for the consumer. So there's plenty of opportunity for consumers to spend more when they feel confident about the future. You know, added to that, businesses are in a similar situation to the consumer. There's a lot of cash on corporate balance sheets. Their balance sheets are relatively healthy, not for all companies, but for a lot of companies. And they're seeing strong demand for their products and services. And, you know, while higher input costs are hurting in the near term, they're able to generate, offset some of those costs through the higher revenues that they're seeing, as well as productivity investments that they've been that have been taking place really over the last several years. So, you know, you've got a strong consumer, you've got strong business. And then the third reason for optimism about the U.S. economy is that state and local governments are sitting on very large surpluses. Some of that money is coming from unspent COVID relief that came from the federal government, but a significant portion of that is coming from higher tax receipts. Most states are seeing, if not record, near record tax receipts this year. And we've seen more than 25 states are currently looking at cutting taxes or providing rebates to consumers. So, you know, that provides an additional amount of potential stimulus for our economy. You know, I wouldn't say the same about economies outside of the US. You know, we do have concerns about the European economy and a potential for a recession there. But for now, we're cautiously optimistic on the state of the US economy. So I'm going to move to page three and dig a little further into the US economy. So on page three, this breaks out the consumer spending in the US economy between goods and services. And I think this page is really instructive for a number of reasons. One, it shows the impact that COVID had on the ways that we spent. And it also really helps highlight why we're having some of the supply and demand imbalances in the economy that are leading to inflationary pressures. So the graph on the left is consumer spending on goods, and the graph on the right is consumer spending on services. Demand for goods really surged during the pandemic, and it's still well above pre-pandemic levels. And this strong demand for goods, as I said, is one of the reasons we're really having a supply-demand imbalance. We have much stronger demand than we are used to. And then a contributing factor to that is the disruption in the supply chain that's continuing to impact the global economy. As we'll talk about later, the Fed can impact the demand for goods, but it can't increase the supply for goods, which is why we believe it'll take more than just Fed action to really get inflation back down to more normal levels. you know, the demand for services. And you can see just by the scaling of these two, in general, services are a much bigger part of our economy in normal times. And even today, there's more dollars going into services. It's just on a relative basis, it's less than it was. We have seen a significant increase in demand for services or spending on services in the last year. And a lot of that is tied to the decline in restrictions across the economy. But we still haven't gotten back to the pre-pandemic level. There are still some lingering restrictions or individual concerns that are impacting travel or, you know, in-person shopping, dining out, and things of that nature. But another thing that's holding back a full recovery in the services sector is some shortages in the labor market, which we'll talk about shortly. But the key takeaway here is that economic growth and inflation have certainly been impacted by the supply of goods that can't meet the stronger than expected demand and the supply of services that has been impacted by shortages in the labor market and COVID restrictions. So I'm going to move on to page 4 and talk a little bit more about the supply chain, how that's contributing to inflation. This chart here is something relatively new that the New York Federal Reserve Bank put together. It's scaled by standard deviations. So the index values you see on the y-axis represent one standard deviation from the normal. So where we are currently over 3% or over 3 means that the pressures on the supply chain are 3 standard deviations above what a normal operating supply chain would look like. A reading at 0 would imply normal operations within the supply chain. This is a global-based index, so it takes data from all over the world. It is weighted by countries' GDPs, but it looks at a combination of data, including the global transportation costs across all kinds, whether it's shipping, freight, train, everything you can think of there. And then it looks at supply chain components like delivery times, order backlogs, the ability to purchase input materials. And then the data is adjusted to strip out the changing demand impacts. So the idea is this tells us it's the supply chain pressures are not heavier because there's more demand. This is just purely, can the current demand be met by the current supply chain? So, you know, again, it's a newer series, but I think it really highlights how difficult supply chain is today and why the supply chain disruptions continue to weigh on inflation. We've seen an improvement here more recently, but this last data point would have been prior to China shutting down some manufacturing and port operations due to their zero COVID policy. So we continue to watch this to get a sense of when we could see a lessening in inflation. Moving on to page 5 and the labor market. You know, I mentioned the labor market as a positive for the consumer, but it's also contributing to some of the inflationary pressures we're seeing. So the graph on the left is the labor force participation rate, which is the percentage of working age population, and that's ages 16 to 64, that are currently employed or seeking employment. So what it's not counting is somebody in that age range who's not even looking for work. It took some time post-pandemic for displaced workers to come back into the labor market. And we're starting to see better improvement over the last several months, but we're still well below the labor market participation rate that we saw pre-pandemic. Part of that is that during the pandemic, we saw higher than normal early retirements. People who were close to retirement and were impacted by the pandemic from a labor market standpoint might have just decided to go ahead and retire early. So those people are out of the labor market sooner than we anticipated. And we also, because of the enhanced unemployment benefits during most of the COVID pandemic, you know, people were paid a sufficient wage in some cases to stay home rather than go back to work. Those benefits are over and they ended in the fall of last year, but it's taking longer than we anticipated to see those workers come back into the market. that's what's driving a lot of the improvement we're seeing over the last couple months, but we'd like to see that continue to move higher. The graph on the right-hand side of the page is the unemployment rate, which is now below 4%, 3.9%, and we'll get another reading on Friday. So it's really pretty close to the pre-pandemic low of 3.5%, which is great. But as we just talked about, that number is lower with a lower number of overall workers in the economy. So a sufficient portion of those people who want to work are in fact working, but there are shortages in the labor market, as we'll see in a little bit more detail on page 6. So this series comes from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, does a monthly survey. It's called the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, but it's commonly referred to as JOLTS, which is a whole lot easier than the full name. So the JOLTS report monthly gives us a reading on the jobs that are available in the market. It breaks them out by sector, by geography, by all kinds of different levels. But so the graph on the left is the ratio of job openings to unemployed. So basically, for each job that's available, how many unemployed people are in theory competing for that job. Right now at 1.75, there's about 1.75 jobs available for each person looking for work. So that, you know, suggests a healthy labor market, but it may also suggest that there's a mismatch between the jobs that are available and the people looking for work. Right now, there's about just over 11 million job openings across the U.S. in various sectors, and seemingly not enough. You know, even if you matched people, the unemployed, perfectly, you would still have significant jobs and no people to fill those jobs. On the right-hand side of the page, I picked just one sector of the market, the leisure and hospitality, because it's so impacted over the last 2 years by COVID. And this is the number of job openings in the leisure and hospitality sector. It's currently just over 1.4 million. And you can see the average over time is just over 600,000. So there's still significant slack in the leisure and hospitality sector in terms of filling openings. And this is really feeding into the difficulty of some areas of the service sector to fully reopen. It's leading to people having to cut back hours or not open every day of the week, or just, you know, worse service than we would like in these areas of the market. And the other piece of it is the inflationary aspect here, that as these businesses reopen, they're having to raise wages to entice people to get back into the labor force and to become employed. And they're also having to raise wages to keep their existing employees from leaving, because in a strong job market, people can move much more readily from one job to another. So there's still this COVID hangover in the labor market. We thought people would come back sooner, but it is taking longer than anticipated, and it's certainly contributing to the inflationary pressures. So I've kind of laid out the economy and the pieces of the economy that are impacting inflation, which is a nice segue to the Federal Reserve and how they're going to combat inflation. And so moving on to page 7, the left-hand side of the page is the Fed funds rate. This is actually, the Fed gives us a target range. And so this is the upper band of that target range. And the dashed green line, lighter green line at the end, is the Fed's forecast for future rate increases. So you can see the Fed is projecting that they'll raise rates at every meeting this year by 25 basis points. On the right-hand side of the page is the PCE price index, the core PCE price index. This is the Fed's preferred measure for inflation. Most of us tend to talk about the consumer price index or CPI, but I think it's important to pay attention to this because it is what the Fed really looks at. One additional point is the Fed likes to focus on the core rate, which excludes food and energy. That's not because food and energy aren't critical to the the economy, but they tend to be more volatile on a month over month basis. And what the Fed wants to do is remove that volatility and really try to hone in on the underlying trend in inflation. So currently the PCE, the core PCE is at 4.9%. Fed's target is 2%, so obviously well above that. We expect that this number is going to rise going forward due to the recent increase in energy prices and the effects of the war in Ukraine before it begins to tail off later this year. And we look at a lot of different measures of consumer and wholesale inflation. I think it's important to look at very many, but this is what the Fed is looking at. And as a comparison, the consumer price index is at the core rate is at 6.4% currently, so a little bit higher than this. But no matter which series you want to look at, inflation is clearly higher than expected and stickier than expected, and the Fed needs to act to remove the emergency accommodation. By waiting to act, as long as they did, they've made that task more difficult because inflation has gotten stickier and more broad-based, and also now we're dealing with disruptions from Ukraine. So, you know, the Fed is trying to slow economic growth enough to reduce demand and bring supply and demand back into balance. But as we've talked about, they can't do that completely on their own. The higher rates can, you know, slow demand for goods and services, but it can't fix the supply chain. It can't, you know, ramp up manufacturing, can't impact COVID in China, and it certainly can't entice people to return to the market. Just looking at the Fed's forecast, you know, we wouldn't be surprised to see the Fed move more aggressively than this in the near term. You know, 25 basis points at every meeting is unusual. They generally don't like to move at every meeting because you know, their policy changes take a while to work through the economy. But this is a recognition that they probably waited too late and they need to move faster. We wouldn't be surprised to see them go 50 basis points at either the May or June meeting. I think that would bolster investor confidence that the Fed is on the job and willing to fight inflation. And I think also it would give them some cover perhaps to move quicker in the near term and then pause and see how the economy reacts. The other thing we're waiting to hear from the Fed is they're going to announce what they're going to do with their balance sheet, which has grown from $4.1 trillion just prior to the pandemic to just under $9 trillion today. It's not certain right now whether they will just let maturities roll off the balance sheet and reduce it that way or look to actually sell assets into the market. We hope to get some information on that at the May Fed meeting. I mean, it's possible they could begin that process at the May meeting. You know, given the maturity breakdown of the Fed's assets, if they were to just reduce the balance sheet by letting bonds mature and not reinvesting, the balance sheet would fall to just over $5.5 trillion over the next 5 years. But a significant portion of the balance sheet is in bonds that mature at longer than 5 years from now, and probably about 40% of it is 10 years or longer. So if they want to be more aggressive this time, they probably can't achieve that just by allowing bonds to mature. When we talk about actual inflation, moving to the next page, I think it's important to look at inflation expectations because inflation expectations are much more correlated with consumer behavior, whereas you know, actual inflation data is more backward looking. So you know, if you think about expectations, if I want to purchase a car this year and I think prices are going to be higher 6 months from now, I'm probably going to move that purchase forward in time. Probably a bad example because cars aren't readily available, but you get the point. But if I think prices are going to be lower later this year, maybe I don't purchase it today and I wait 6 months to buy it at lower prices. So that's how expectations for inflation can impact consumer behavior. And it really gives us some insight and it helps the Fed as well to get a sense for how demand might be changing over time and ultimately how fast or slow the Fed can react to reduce inflation. The graph that you're looking at here is the break-even inflation rate from the Treasury Inflation Protected Market or the TIPS market. So looking at just the two-year break-even, that's the yield difference between a two-year Treasury bond and a two-year TIPS bond. And that is a proxy for expected inflation over time. The two-year break-even right now is at 4.9%, which means that expectations are that inflation will average 4.9% over the next 2 years. As you move further out the curve to the 10-year in this case, inflation expectations decline because people think that while inflation is high in the short run today, they expect longer-term inflation trends to be lower. So the 10-year is currently at 2.9%. So on average, people expect that inflation will average just under 3% over the next 10 years. Again, higher than the Fed's long-term target, but the Fed has told us that they are willing to allow inflation to run higher for some time. You know, so the higher current inflation isn't expected to last, and it should decline over time as the Fed removes accommodation and hopefully the other supply chain and labor market issues are worked through. But I think watching expectations really gives us some hint about how quickly or slowly the Fed might move to continue to normalize. So when you talk about an active Fed, the next question is, what is the impact on interest rates? And we're going to move to that on page 9 and really talk about the market implications of everything I've discussed so far. So here you're looking at the yield to maturity of a two-year Treasury bond and a 10-year Treasury bond. The yield on the two-year really began to move higher in the fourth quarter of last year when it became clear that inflation was going to be around longer and it was becoming more broad-based. So the two-year or the front end of the curve is really much more correlated to expectations for changes in Fed monetary policy. Longer maturity bonds like the 10-year are more impacted by expectations for economic growth and inflation, but they can sometimes be impacted by other factors like global demand for yield, the Fed's QE program, debt purchases, which stopped at the beginning of this month, but up till now have been putting some downward pressure on long-term rates. More recently, you know, when geopolitical risk or market risk is higher, you tend to see a flight to quality where people go out of riskier assets into higher quality assets, and that tends to put some pressure on the longer part of the yield curve. So while we are seeing 10-year yields rise, that increase has mostly happened in the last couple of weeks as the Fed has really shifted monetary policy. So, you know, the two-year Treasury is yielding about 2.3% currently, and the 10-year Treasury is yielding around 2.5%. We expect that rates are going to continue to rise really across the curve, but how the Fed decides to reduce the balance sheet may put additional pressure on the longer maturity bonds. If they do decide to sell assets, that could lead to a near-term higher rates on the back end of the curve than we might expect if they don't. But overall, you know, the Fed has been the primary buyer of long-term treasuries for the last 2 years as part of its QE program. So without Fed buying, there could be some upward pressure on those yields until the traditional buyers come back. You know, but unless inflation expectations remain elevated for longer than we anticipate, we don't think we're going to see a dramatic increase in interest rates, and that we might end both on the short and the long term at levels similar to where we ended the last Fed cycle in 2016, 18, 19. So more like a 3% to 4% range. I'm going to do something a little different right here. One of the questions that we received ahead of the call was about the potential for an inverted yield curve. So since I have a yield chart up here, I thought I would answer that question now rather than waiting till the end. So when we talk about the potential inversion of the yield curve, what people most commonly are looking at is the difference in yield between the two-year and the 10-year Treasury bond. When the curve is inverted, that means the yield of the 10-year bond is lower than the yield of the two-year bond. And that's what we would call a yield curve inversion. When long-term rates fall below short-term rates, it's generally believed to be a sign that the longer-term economic outlook has weakened and that interest rates in the future will need to be lower to stimulate growth. But there can be a number of other factors that can impact the shape of the yield curve at any point in time. And some of those are the things we talked about just a minute ago, flight to quality and the Fed being in the market. So currently, the spread between the 2 and 10 year is at 13 basis points. It was 65 basis points 12 months ago. So that is significantly flatter than it was, but it hasn't inverted at this point. But we continue to watch that. I think the important message on yield curve inversion is it can be a signal of a recession in the next 12 to 18 months, but it doesn't automatically, it's not a perfect signal of recession. So we have had yield curve inversions that do not lead to a recession. And what I think is probably the most important for the near term as we look at it is that it is a market signal and it could impact investor sentiment in the short run, but not necessarily be a sign that a recession is coming. Moving to the last page on the equity markets, what you're looking at here is the earnings per share of the S&P 500 over time, and it's on a quarterly basis. I think that when you look at this chart, much like the first chart that we started with on GDP, the important message here, the green lines are previous earnings per share per quarter, and the blue lines at the end are the estimates through the end of 2023. And even with the level of uncertainty, the higher inflation, and the supply chain disruptions we're seeing, earnings are still expected to grow this year and next year, somewhere in the mid to high single digit levels. So certainly less earnings growth than we've seen over the last couple of years, but we still are looking for positive earnings growth. The other thing that corollary off of this is looking at the market as a whole, but it really doesn't tell us what's going on under the surface with the 500 companies in the S&P. We've seen a divergence in the performance across sectors, market cap, and among individual names and sectors throughout the year. The correction in the market that we saw earlier was much greater if you move down to smaller companies. Technology and consumer discretionary sectors experienced a much larger sell-off than did the more defensive sectors. And I think it's a recognition that not all companies are in the same position in order to be able to navigate through this high level of uncertainty. So, you know, while the overall market that we're looking at here, you know, underlying that, there's good quality companies that have solid growth opportunities and that are more attractive than the market as a whole. And we expect that the market's going to continue to differentiate between those good companies and those that don't have strong earnings prospects or don't have earnings at all. And that's a much healthier environment for investing. When the market distinguishes between good companies with growth prospects and those that don't, versus what we've been in for much of the time since the bottoming of the market in March of 2023 or 2020, excuse me, where the rising tide lifted all boats. So we much prefer an environment where there's differentiation. So to talk a little bit, pulling all of this together into the portfolio impacts, and I know we're going a little long, but I'll be quick here. You know, the risk to the economy and the financial markets is higher than it was at the beginning of the year. But even with that level of uncertainty, there are a lot of positive things that we think can support the economy and provide opportunity for well-positioned companies. We really believe our current portfolio companies are well positioned for this environment. They have solid balance sheets, strong cash generation, and the ability to deal with near-term uncertainty and pricing pressures. And they have proven track records of generating positive results in a slower growth, a slower economic growth environment. You know, some of our companies are facing more near-term pressures in their business due to higher energy prices or the less demand for services. But we continue to focus on the long-term growth prospects and really aren't going to react unless that fundamental long-term outlook for a company or for a sector is altered. And I think it's important too to reiterate, you know, the importance of portfolio diversification. And so while prices of some of our holdings have declined more than the market this year, the portfolio overall has benefited from diversification, and it's providing protection on the downside, as we would expect. The other thing I think is important when we look at the portfolio is to remember that in the short run, the price of a company's stock can move for a lot of reasons, and not all of them are related to the fundamentals of the company or the sector that they're in. But over the longer term, prices will reflect the fundamentals of the company and their prospects for sales and earnings growth. So from a portfolio perspective, with the amount of uncertainty, we're being really cautious in managing the position sizes in the portfolio to maintain diversification. So you may have noticed we've been taking profits on positions that have outperformed probably a little quicker than we might in a calmer or less volatile market. We did it recently. For those of you that have growth, you might have seen some energy companies be cut back. We did it in some income companies as well. We really just want to take advantage of taking gains and taking profits when stocks outperform, and not letting the position sizes get too large. Higher interest rates are making fixed income more attractive, but with rates expected to rise more from here, we're not really adding a lot of duration to the fixed income portfolio. But for those of you with a fixed income allocation, we are buying some investment grade corporate bonds, keeping the maturity relatively short. That will allow us to reinvest at higher rates in the future while still earning an attractive yield today. And I think, you know, fixed income has done its job of providing diversification from equity risk, especially this year. But now we're finally in an environment where it can also return to providing some incremental income. And then finally, I think it's just the last thing I want to reiterate, and then I promise I'll stop, is, you know, timing the market is extremely difficult. And historically speaking, event-driven market underperformance tends to be short-term in nature. So staying invested in times of uncertainty is not always easy. Investors who do stay in the market and focused on high-quality companies have generated better results over time. That's not to say we won't or couldn't make changes to the portfolio if we see the situation deteriorate from what our current forecast is. And we continue to monitor all the incoming information, both, you know, macroeconomic, the level of uncertainty, and the bottom-up information on our companies. And we're ready to make changes if we feel that the fundamental underpinnings of the economy or our companies have changed. So with that, I know I answered one of the questions already. We got several questions on inflation that hopefully I have addressed through the things that I covered. So I am going to stop sharing my screen, and I'm going to go back to Michael to see if he has additional questions that I should be addressing.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Jean. We do have a couple questions, but we are over time now. So I am sorry to everyone who asked questions. I apologize we didn't get to more, but we will, of course, address those individually after the call and make sure that we get all the information to everybody that they need. We received some feedback on how we can improve the clarity of the data series that we have in our chart pack, and we are going to take that to heart and incorporate this when we do post it after the call for everyone to refer back to. We appreciate that feedback, especially in any feedback on how we can improve our communications. If anyone has any additional questions after this, you can reach out to your advisor, or you can email questions@gautziandgibb.com. And with that, I just want to say thank you again, Jean. Great job as always. I feel better after listening to your presentation. I hope other people do as well. And if anyone has any additional feedback about this or any other presentation that we've given, please feel free to reach out. And with that, I will release everyone back to their mornings. So thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone.